I think that, again, it depends on just how far somebody goes. I mean, there are some super aggressive plaintiff lawyers that you pick up the phone and call them, you have the best conversation on the planet after you just went through a string of emails that you'd rather not read out loud. And, you know, you pick up the phone and you talk to them. It's like you're talking to a different person. You're like, listen, give me 2 weeks. Let me dive into this. And 99% of the time, you know this, if you're a human and you call somebody, everybody wants to get to the same place in the end. Everybody wants to find a resolution where either everybody's a little happy or everyone's a little ticked off.
Today on The Injury Pros, we're joined by Andrew Race, an attorney with Moore, Ingram, Johnson & Steele. Andrew practices in their litigation group with a strong focus on insurance defense. He lives here locally, serving the Philadelphia area, and is licensed in both New Jersey and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Andrew has a background representing plaintiffs in personal injury and workers' compensation matters, giving a unique kind of understanding of both sides. He brings a wealth of trial experience and has truly seen a lot in the courtroom, many of the reasons why I've been looking forward to this conversation. So first and foremost, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So just jumping right into this, we were kind of talking off screen. It seems to be the tendency with these episodes. We talk off screen, then we jump into it. On my side of the aisle, the plaintiff's bar, we're called the ambulance chasers. The defense side, representing the insured and corporations and individuals, you guys are called the shark. But the interesting part about both of this is, in the grand scheme of things, neither of us really holds the bag. What I mean by that is, kind of talk to me through the sense of behind the scenes as it pertains to, we're litigating a case, I'm giving a demand, you're giving a counteroffer. Some people think that you're the one steering the bus, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but ultimately the adjuster or the insured company, the insurance company or the trucking company or whoever is being insured, is the individual that's saying, all right, Andrew, you can make the call, you can offer this. Talk to me a little bit about some things that I don't get to see in the background. I'm usually making the call saying, Andrew, we can get this done at X amount. Let's make it happen. When I hang up the phone, where does it start for you?
Sure. So it really starts from that initial evaluation. We get a defense file in and we start working through what we have. How did the accident occur? A police report, medical records. And we evaluate it very similarly to a plaintiff's lawyer early on in the case. And then as we get into the beginning of discovery, we really start to look at, is there anything prior? You know, are there multiple car accidents in the plaintiff's history or multiple work injuries? And when we first evaluate the value of a claim, we typically would tell the insurer or the third-party administrator, this is the typical value in this venue based on either jury verdicts or published settlements, or if it's workers' comp, you might do weeks, months, years of wage loss benefits. You know, plus medical benefits.
And how often are they actually listening to the? Because sometimes I feel it on my end, and sometimes I hear it in the voice of defense attorneys that I work with. You can almost sense that there's some empathy and some sympathy that resonates on both sides, especially when we're so close to the finish line. You talked about your evaluation, and that's pretty spot on to what we're looking at. When I always tell people it's a triangle, a personal injury case, you have ultimately three sides of a triangle, as we all know. Even being an English major, I know that. Awful at math. But notwithstanding, you have the 3 points. You have the liability. If it's my client's fault, I'm not even in the ballgame. Then we go and look at the injuries. I tell people this religiously. If you call for a broken nail, it's not a case that we are taking. And I say that not in disrespect to you, but I'm not going to drag you through the mud for a cracked nail or something that we can't ultimately prove. And then that last part, where many times your side comes in, is coverage. Coverage in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania can be as low as $15,000, as you know. In New Jersey, they just bumped it up to $25,000. Hopefully that follows suit with Pennsylvania. Or it can go $250,000, umbrella millions, or self-insured, which the sky's the limit. So it's interesting to hear your perspective, because that's literally what we're doing on the other side. And there's no Pandora's box that you're releasing top secret code, nuclear codes, or anything of the sort. But how does the conversation get from that point to, all right, this is a number we feel comfortable? Are you baking in, hey, you have to go get experts, they have 10 experts, or there's a chance we win this, so we're going to no offer in full defense? How many times do you feel that you're actually working collaboratively with adjusters? You don't have to drop names here. If you do, I'm sure that Alex can blurt it out or put some of the explicit language so you hear it. But notwithstanding, how do you actually get to the point where it's not like, hey, adjuster, I'm going to wring your neck if we don't get this done, and make that jump from the initial evaluation? Because I'm on the other side trying to get this done quick, and I know that I'm not the only file.
So 90-95% of the time, the adjusters listen to us. They're fantastic. You may not know a lot, or the folks watching may not know, a lot of adjusters work in multiple states. So they probably have triple the files we do, which is pretty hard to work with because they have to touch every file every so often, every 30 days or every 45 days. So that's one factor, and you want to be ahead of them on that. But the other factor is, and many insurers or third-party administrators who are controlling the money for the insured or self-insured, they have what we call desk authority or limits on authority before they have to go up the chain. And every time you go up the chain, you have to do either a settlement authority request or there's some paperwork you have to fill out, meetings have to be had, and now you're bringing more people in, so more questions. Yet you're bringing more people up to speed on the facts and the potential exposure, if any.
And how chaotic is that? Because my father, God rest his soul, would always say, opinions are like a-holes. Everyone's got one. I don't know if we'll get censored for that, Alex, but I'm sure you can work that out. But how the more people you admire, because on the plaintiff side, I love the fact of having multiple people, and I'm sure you do as well, to bounce ideas off. I go home, I talk to my wife. I'll come in and I'll talk to our intake. I'll talk to our paralegals. And then you start to move, like, I'll give my friend a call and just give it a neutral opinion of facts. But it seems that at least the more people in the room, the more problematic it may become. Do you find that that rings true with defense, where everyone is really like, I don't believe it. I think it should be a lower offer on the lower tier of that spectrum rather than the high.
Frankly, that can happen. What we try to do at our firm is present the options. I don't want to say this is what you should do. I want to say this is what you can do. These are the potential results if you do any of these options. You guys tell me what your decision is. And I think that way the client, the client has to make the decision. They're making the decision. Because I don't want it to come back that Attorney Ray said I have to pay X. Generally, in my experience, and I've been doing this for over 11 years now, I tend to see whoever's on top, whether it's a self-insured who's writing the check, or the manager of the insurance company, everyone kind of follows suit. We kind of present it and they lead the discussion when you start talking dollars and cents.
So it's interesting. So one of the stats that we were talking about a little bit ago was in 2023, the Court of Common Pleas in PA had 128,000 civil cases docketed statewide. So on top of that, in Pennsylvania, only about less than under 1%. Usually it's half to 1% of all civil cases end up in a jury trial in any given year. So you would think that both sides are doing their job because you're getting to a number where the risk is not worth the squeeze. And it's interesting to kind of hear the backstory of how you get to that point, because on my end, I'm like, well, I emailed them yesterday. Why is it taking so long? It's a very simple yes or no, but it doesn't seem as simple as it may be put. But that being said, in the intro, we talked a little bit about how you did some plaintiff's work and then you went to defense. How was that transition? Because I know that my mother, and I'm comparing apples to oranges here, I was a prosecutor for many years in Philadelphia County as a district attorney and then Middlesex County as a prosecutor. My mother always told me, she goes, you're doing God's work, blah, 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 blah. If you ever became a defense attorney and you ever represented any of those bad people, I'd disown you. I'm like, Mom, yeah, sure. She's like, no, I would. How do you stomach that with, obviously, I know you off screen, you're a stand-up fella, you're very good at your job. We would have a beer together. How do you deal with that dynamic of, like, I used to represent these people on the plaintiff side. Now I'm doing defense. I guess to our viewers listening that are non-lawyers, as jaded as possible, how do you sleep at night, I guess is the question.
Well, I get that question a lot, actually, and speaking that you were a prosecutor, I did criminal defense work in Lebanon County. So, short story, out in Lebanon County, they do court-appointed public defender work. So if the public defender has a conflict, you get a nice order from the court, you're going to represent this person. And I've done anything from homicides to DUIs. So how do you sleep at night? you're doing your job. You're holding, you know, whether it's the prosecutor to follow the rules. Defense work, you're trying to get the best deal for your client. Oftentimes, the injuries are real. Oftentimes, the accident occurred. Oftentimes, true liability disputes aren't as often as they seem. A true dispute is pretty rare.
Do you feel that your conscience sometimes enters into the fray, or do you have to kind of snap yourself back and be objective in a sense of saying, okay, this is the goal. This is what I'm doing. I'm trying to maintain status quo to ultimately the end result is to have your client not be liable because then they're off scot-free. Or the alternative would be to minimize, as you said, the damage that they are susceptible or the resolution being as minimal as possible.
Look, your conscience absolutely comes into play, whether it's an accepted claim in workers' comp and maybe the claimant fell off repetitive pay through no fault of anybody, just either a computer glitch or somebody didn't go in and reset the repetitive pay on time. And, you know, someone who's living on workers' compensation benefits, their check is late and they're all bent out of shape, rightfully so. So sometimes it's just about navigating those hurt feelings while still saying to my client, hey, you know, you didn't intend for this. You did everything correct. Let's get this fixed and move forward.
Is there anything that you like better in the defense realm than when you were doing plaintiff? I know, obviously, talking a little bit earlier, there's that connection to the plaintiff that has been injured allegedly or factually, and you get to make kind of a connection with them. You form a bond, as I know you know, where you're calling them because you're going through the worst part of their life. On the defense side, is that similar to the insured? Like, what would you say that you kind of like more on the defense side than not so much on the plaintiff side?
So I think on the defense side, first of all, you have more resources. The insurers have the ability, obviously they have more money. They have the deep pockets, and that's the famous line. So you have the resources if you need a private investigator or if you need to get medical reports. You're not really constrained by the risks that you have on the plaintiff side. If you lose, you're out those costs. So just that you can get what you need much more quickly with a lot less fuss.
Are they giving you, and obviously I don't want you to divulge too much if you can't, but are they giving you more so of a budget where it's almost as all of us adults kind of do, we take a step back and we'll Excel spreadsheet our expenses for the month or the year to budget. Is that kind of something similar, or do they really give you the keys and say, have at it?
So we definitely budget. We definitely prepare budgets, and they're reviewed periodically and updated as needed. And it's part of that open line of communication. Hey, here's where we're at. Here's what got complex. And much like with your plaintiffs, we're updating our clients at least every 30 days, if not less. You know, even if there's nothing going on, you want to shoot them that quick email and say, hey, we have this coming up in October. There's really not a whole lot going on in September. Give me a call if you need anything.
And you made a mention about advertising. One of the things that just triggered my mind. From a plaintiff side, we're always out there trying to be in the forefront, developing relationships with the community, making sure that we're front and center on top of the head for knowledge, whatever it may be. Obviously, the defense side is much different in regards to advertising. You're not posting on LinkedIn, hey, we just got a settlement for X. I sometimes do see that if it's a summary judgment or something that would be beneficial in the defense realm. How are you guys acquiring these clients? Is there an advertisement thing? Is it just a word of mouth? Does the results driven that people want to affiliate, say, similar in the plaintiff's world, just the opposite? Because obviously, I'm never going to see you on a commercial saying, call us, I'll be your defense attorney. That's just not how this world works. I've always wondered, at least in my mind, like, okay, where there's always water in the well, and there's a lot of other defense terms. Obviously, the firm you're with is one that's well known, but how does the water not dry up? And I say that, obviously, I just quoted that 128,000 civil docketed cases in the Commonwealth occurred. So there's never short of work, but how do you ultimately make sure that that's replenished and that they keep coming back for more and they're happy at the end of the day?
So word of mouth is the number one biggest thing, just like with you guys. All the commercials in the world don't do you any good if your clients hate you. So your adjusters are humans. I mean, make that personal relationship, get to know them, be likable, you know, taking interest in them, taking interest in what they're going through on their end, and navigate your file in a way that you can help make their life easier. And it just kind of trickles. And one thing that not a lot of folks know is there's a lot of turnover in insurance adjusting, where you go from one company to another. And a lot of times, if you have that good relationship, it follows.
That makes sense. So at least on our end, the plaintiff, and for those people out there that aren't really familiar with the process, basically, ultimately, if an incident happens, it could be a premise, it could be a motor vehicle crash, it could be dram shop, it could be a variety of different things, even the workers' comp world. Ultimately, what happens is you put in a claim, and that claim, ultimately, that file is assigned to an adjuster. And many times, Andrew, you don't even come in until it's litigation, unless it's a workers' comp issue or something that requires court intervention. But more times than not, you don't enter the fray until after that point. So when you inherit a file, how long does the process take for you to feel comfortable to speak intelligently to it? I mean, I've had it many times. We all have worked collectively in high school, college, post-grad, where we have group projects, and there's always that person who really does a good job with the group project, and then there's that person that's just hoping that they get the A. Yeah. And one of the sayings that we would always say on the baseball team in my undergrad would be, don't kick the can down the aisle. And basically, what it basically means is like, oh, there's the can. I'm not going to pick it up. I'm just going to kick it into the next person. Do you feel that the files that you're obtaining from these adjusters are, obviously, you're going to have good ones, obviously, you're going to have bad ones, but do you feel that those are, when you receive them, the status that they're in allows you to do more or less with it, where you can move a case quicker when you receive it that way?
So I think that's in some ways a toss-up. In the personal injury realm, sometimes it's as good as how soon the plaintiff's lawyer got involved, how good the demand package is that a plaintiff lawyer might produce. The information they give you, that's always really helpful. Sometimes it depends on the cooperation of medical providers. If you have an out-of-state medical provider, they're not going to necessarily cooperate with subpoenas very well, you know, unless you properly coordinate the subpoena with whatever state that provider's in and follow their local rules. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of what adjuster you draw, what records they can get. Does the injured person sign a release, you know, before we have subpoena power? Obviously, in the personal injury world, you're probably at least a year and a half in on most cases before a suit's filed. You have a 2-year statute.
And do you feel, kind of peeling this back a little bit, on the plaintiff's side, we always have this mantra that sometimes rings true when it involves individuals. We believe many individuals are sorry that this crash occurred, or this premise slip and fall that happened, or whatever incident took place, they regret it happening. And the reality, though, is that these people, many times the defendant or the corporations, don't really get to interact with the plaintiff. And what I mean by that is that they're not powwowing. They're both represented, and they kind of talk through us. Do you feel that in mediations or times when these people, both parties, collide, that there's more empathy and sympathy across the aisle than what is put out in the media, or how everybody's kind of banging heads? Because at least in my experiences, look at the plaintiff side, a lot of the attorneys, defense alike, they're reasonable people. They're reasonable people. They're more than happy to have a meeting of the minds, and so are their clients. It just seems sometimes that water is muddied when the adjuster takes in, because the adjuster has even a higher level of responsibility than per se you have. And how do you kind of see that dynamic play out when the case is progressing? Do you see the adjusters becoming more realistic, more reasonable as time goes on from your relationship? Or do you see it kind of just, this is very black and white to the adjuster, and that's how it is?
I think that again depends on the type of defendant you have, corporation versus individual. So to go to like in mediations, like you mentioned, you get a car accident. You have, you know, Joe hits Janet and they get into a car accident. I think in that mediation room, you know, if you're back in the in-person days especially, I think that connection goes a long way. All of a sudden, that plaintiff who is probably been egregiously injured by an accident. I mean, negligence is an accident.
That is what it is, yeah.
And sees this defendant who, like, I did not mean to hurt you. I think that just makes a world of difference because people, a lot of times people want to be heard. They want to be seen.
Now, I've been beating you up a little bit with the grievances on the plaintiff side. I'm going to give you the spotlight now. What do you see on your end that if what really grinds your gears when it comes to us, the plaintiff's bar, in a sense of complaints being filed, and I mean like a formal complaint, not like me complaining, and just moving a case to resolution. Is there certain things that you see on repeat when it's kind of like a, oh, here we go again, and the music starts and it's kind of just an outward sigh?
Probably the most common is the initial demand. And you'll see in Philadelphia County, for example.
I love Philadelphia. Everybody loves Philadelphia on the plaintiffs.
90% of the time, that initial demand is $1 million or more. In workers' comp, 5-6 years worth of benefits. You and I both know the average injury is going to heal in far less than 5 or 6 years. And frankly, $1 million is the exception and not the rule, even in Philadelphia. But while we know you have to, I know you have to start somewhere. You know I'm going to start low because we're all trying to get the best deal for our clients and we're ultimately going to get where we need to go most of the time. That adjuster who is getting $1 million demand 8 times a day is just like, you've got to be kidding me.
It's interesting you say that because everybody has a different strategy on negotiation and I do my negotiations. I've touched on it a little bit. I'm not the cookie cutter, let's tier and box kind of thing. I find that when I come to an attorney or an adjuster and I say, this is my lowest number. I'm not jerking your chain. I'm not BSing you. I'm not lying. This is what the case merits based on the economic and non-economic damages. This is what I want. More times than so, I usually get in the ballpark of that number. However, I feel talking with my counterparts and individuals, colleagues on the bar side for the plaintiffs, they feel that that $1 million offer allows them to reduce within reason, like you said. So in theory, if I'm demanding $1 million and you're at zero, the halfway point is $500,000. How many times that happens? I'd say probably zero. But not being said, the old train of thought of thinking is start high and then work your way down, because once you give away money, you can't take it back. And for those people listening, negotiation is very straight simple. It's like, hey, I think the case is worth X. That's confined by the policy. As we talked about earlier, policy might be anywhere from $15,000 up to $250,000 or umbrellas of $1 million or self-insured, which means there is no limit. But that being said, you got to be reasonable. And I feel like that goes a long way. But how many times do you feel the $1 million offer actually settles for $1 million? Or is it never?
Very rarely. I'll tell you, I've had $1 million settlement in my career. I've been lucky enough, unfortunately, it was a very bad tractor-trailer accident. Somebody passed away. It was at night, in the rain, driving too fast. Again, mistake, 100% mistake. But somebody lost their life, and I was a young adult, you know, married. And so those are the types of things where you're thinking $1 million plus, or a child who's egregiously injured, or someone. Look, you know, you lost a limb in a car accident, or, you know, you're 40 and you're a software engineer and you can never work again. You know, those are the things that off the top of my head I think of. But the issue isn't so much the $1 million demand. I think the issue comes in the frustration a little bit. And you guys probably had the same frustration with us when it's every case, no matter the facts. So you may have a car accident where you get the MRI, you know, you take an expert deposition, it's clearly not worth $750,000. And you're still saying to me, well, we want $750,000. We all know it's not going to settle for $750,000. We know the odds of a jury giving you $750,000 are fairly low, but unpredictable.
Philadelphia County, you never know. But that it's interesting that you say that, though, because MRI is objective findings, but it's amazing how even in objective finding, you can see it so many different ways. You have a radiologist who looks at it and says, oh, I see a disc bulge. Then you have a neurosurgeon, but I think we both can agree, a little more experienced than the radiologist based on his training. That ultimately turns into a herniation. And then You have a defense doctor who says, nah, it's the disc bulge. And that's where the arguments, it's there's fine words of difference that ultimately create the cases and what they become. I always think it's interesting when you, as I'm sure you just mentioned too, every time from a defense side, we're saying herniation, other side saying, oh, this is degenerative disc disease or something. And I don't think that it's just the same arguments over time. I just think both sides, defense and plaintiff, have molded themselves into these positions where they're looking at cases kind of through a very narrow glass. And you only have so many things that you can do because you can't be unreasonable. You can't just very much so, like a defense attorney, can throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. You can have an alibi, you can have a motive, you can have those things and start to. On a plaintiff defense side, you can't say if there's an objective finding of an MRI that there's at least a bulge or there's some an EMG that's positive showing radiculopathy. I don't think it's within the realm of reasonableness to come back and say, you know what, that person is the healthiest person alive. They're 100% cured. This has nothing to do with it. But those arguments are sometimes made. Mm-hmm. I kind of like those arguments from my side of the bar because you can sometimes show the unreasonableness. But I also think that it also shows the strength on both sides. Because on the flip side, there's been times where I'll send my client to a neuropsych. Neuropsych comes back and goes, everything's fine. But in my mind, I'm like, there's got to be something wrong with them because they're having memory failures. They're having cognitive deficiencies. They're stuttering their words or their memory lapses. And it can't just be old age. I have non-impact witnesses that are supporting that. And that being said, defense experts like, well, this is the reason why. So I always like, it's like a tennis match back and forth of, all right, I'll give you this, you give me that. And I find that those cases settle more often than not because you don't paint yourself into a corner, but you have to, like you said, you have to be realistic to a jury. Do you see that is similar on your side too, where you get an expert report from your doctor and you're like, oh, this is not what I wanted to see? Or do you kind of see the flip side of that where there are always doctors, and I say this, preface this with, there's good doctors, there's bad doctors, there's good lawyers, there's bad lawyers, there's good cops, there's bad cops. We both know that there's a bunch of defense doctors. I know that there's a bunch of plaintiffs. And religiously, they're saying whatever they want to say. And they're going to say what we want them to say because they want to keep us happy. They want to keep the business coming. How many times do you see a report that actually helps the plaintiff side?
More than you would think, particularly in workers' comp. And one thing I try to do, and I won't speak for any other defense lawyer on the planet, is I would never suggest to my expert what their opinion should be. I try to be very objective. Here's what I have. Here's what we think. Here's what they said and testified. I will give them the transcripts. I always like to give them the images of the diagnostic studies. I mean, you and I both know how important that is. The doctor that views the images as opposed to the report, whether right or wrong, has at least a slight increase in credibility.
And you touch a bit, like, not to suggest or opine for the expert what they should and shouldn't say. Running very closely with that thought is also just the respect in general and ethics and everything else that's involved. How do you find that you're treated from the plaintiff's bar in your personal opinion? Obviously, you're not talking for every defense attorney. Respect it? Do you run into some individuals who just, plaintiffs and attorneys who just like, I don't give two craps about you. This is my goal. I'm going to run this to the mill. I'm going to jam it down your throat. Give me what I want. Rah, rah, rah. Jump up and down, or I'm going to make this a miserable experience for you.
So there's a couple of those, just like there's some defense attorneys that when I did plaintiff and claimants work that I dreaded working against. It's just how it is. People are people. Like you said, there's good cops, bad cops, good lawyers, bad lawyers. There's really aggressive lawyers, no matter what the case is. Aggression is their style. You know that's what they're going to do.
Does that get anywhere? Does that get anywhere, though? Like, because I can see it working both sides. Obviously, it puts the fire to the heels of defense because you're churning out, as a plaintiff's attorney, reports, boom, 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 piling it on, boom, boom, boom. And it's almost like you want that oh crap moment by defense to be like, all right, we can't handle this right now. Not that we're not able to, but this is a lot of information that ultimately may justify the tendering of our policy. Do you find that aggression or aggressive tactics is productive? Or do you find on the flip side, you're like, all right, I can't deal with this right now. I'm not going to get to this now. Expert reports aren't even due yet. What are you doing? put it to the side until it's ripe?
I think that, again, it depends on just how far somebody goes. I mean, there are some super aggressive plaintiff lawyers that you pick up the phone and call them, you have the best conversation on the planet after you just went through a string of emails that you'd rather not read out loud. And you know, you pick up the phone and you talk to them. It's like you're talking to a different person. You're like, listen, give me 2 weeks. Let me dive into this. And 99% of the time, you know this, if you're a human and you call somebody, everybody wants to get to the same place in the end. Everybody wants to find a resolution where either everybody's a little happy or everyone's a little ticked off.
The way that I describe it with most people is I say, in a settlement that's appropriate, unless it's a jury verdict, this is just a settlement. This means basically you make the offer, I counter, we go back and forth, and it's accepted. If that's the case and it's not in front of a jury, you should feel a little dirty. You should walk away and you should feel like, I wish I could have got more, but I feel that I could have got less. I don't feel that I robbed the bank, but I don't feel that I got ripped off. And it's a very weird feeling, especially if you hit that number, because no one's celebrating on either side. Obviously, you're not celebrating. It's not like you have one of those charts that say, all right, we saved $10,000. Now we can go to the water park next week because we can rebudget this elsewhere. It's not like we're celebrating on our side that we got a great number. We're just happy that the person who was hurt got compensated. You guys are happy that you're able to get a fair value. It's kind of like going to a car dealership. It's almost how sometimes I'll talk about it too. It's like you go in and you're like, I have a number in mind. If I get that number, I'm going to feel great. If I overpay a little bit, I'm like, okay, I'm not that mad about it. And then the bargaining back and forth begins. Do you find that is a similar experience that you have? Or I know with some adjusters will call me and they'll say, I need to get this file off my desk. Help me get this file off my desk. And I understand the dynamic, being an English major and using certain words, that they say file for an array of reasons. It kind of takes out the personality, and this isn't bashing them or anything of the sort. It's just the reality that if you're seeing the same injury, that same $1 million offer every day, you have to do something to kind of not turn your brain off, but to see it very black and white. Or the worst thing I feel like an adjuster can do, and we as plaintiff attorneys always want them to do that, is to invoke emotion. Because I think you and I both can agree, it's not so much the economics that we argue about. It's very simple on the economic side. The damages are related, causally related to the injury or the accident or the fall, or they're not. The non-economic, meaning the loss of enjoyment of life, the humiliation, the inability to do what they were once doing, are the numbers that keep us both up at night, because you don't know what it is. I can't sit here and say, you know what, Andrew, my client is a 21-year-old. They're in college. They play college volleyball, and they broke their wrist because of the negligence of your insured. And every game that they can't play in their senior year is worth $1,000. There's no chart for that. I can make the argument, but I think that's kind of sometimes the interesting part, is a plaintiff side talking with an adjuster or talking with defense attorney to say, this is what they're going to say to the jury. And that's many times, at least for me, that I hear the empathy in the voice of the defense attorney. I'm not saying that they don't have it otherwise, but it's almost not talking about the injury, but talking how the impact occurs.
And that's absolutely true. And that's why you'll see defense attorneys, I can't do a lot until I get into discovery and get some depositions. We want to get eyes on this injured person.
Those are the words I hate them. I hate when I file something and the first, and it hit the nail on the head, where they say, I need to get the deposition. I need to get the deposition first. And I'm like, just give me the discovery. Let's get the deposition. Let's get this done. But it makes perfect sense now. And I don't mean to cut you off, but you're assessing more than just the damages at that point. When you go into a deposition and you prep, what is your best day as a defense attorney in deposition? Obviously, short of them saying, you know what, it was my fault, your client didn't do anything, then we're SOL.
My best day is I'm not fighting with the witness. We're having a conversation and I'm just learning. Because you generally think it's going to be the truth. You're going to get the most information. And you and I both know, and we've all coached witnesses in preparation, only answer the question asked. When people start talking, that's the best information you can.
I say it every day, and sometimes people listen, sometimes people don't. I'll get on my soapbox real quick. Answer the question and only the question. When you get diarrhea of the mouth, I call it, is when you bury yourself in a hole deeper than Alice in Wonderland when she goes down that tunnel. And it's almost, it's almost like theatric, cinematic, because I see the eyes when my client is talking, because you get nervous. People get nervous. It happens. There's nothing you can do about it. Nobody wants to sit there. We don't even like it, to doing depositions that much. It's an awkward thing. It's adversarial at its peak. And you just see when my clients start talking, the eyes of the defense attorney just lighting up like a Christmas tree, like Rockefeller Center, just lighting up, because my client's going to give them information that they probably didn't even know, that they weren't going to elicit, but they're so nervous that they go through it. My best day as a plaintiff's attorney is when I can just get the defendant to admit wrong, because that locks in my liability. And many times you'd be amazed, as a simple question of a rear end, what actions or inactions do you believe caused this crash? Well, your client slammed on the brakes. That's not what I asked, though. And it's interesting how even the simplest question evokes defense. And it's interesting to see how that plays out. But besides the general conversation, once you're done the deposition, is that the end all be all, or are you doing a report? Are you a new thing that I recently saw in a deposition is they took a picture of my client. Obviously, they know who they are, and I can't object to that. But it's putting a face to words, and I think that that is something that evokes emotion too.
So absolutely, at that point is when the adjuster, the adjuster's manager, the manager's manager, and depending on the carrier, that's when they want that human side. How does this person present? For example, I was defending the case. It was a 10-year-old. He was running in Philadelphia street where row homes, and they were doing construction on the facade. And it's Philadelphia. The fence fell over. The kid knew he wasn't supposed to be playing there. He played there. Parents weren't watching him. You know, any other county, an adult, you're thinking, okay, I might have negligent supervision, comparative negligence. He knew he wasn't supposed to be there. So I'm sitting with my client, and we're having a loss meeting, getting ready to decide how we want to approach this. And I said this, 10-year-old Philadelphia jury, scar. That was all it took.
It makes, because I think, and going back to the file thing, I think that that's the point in time where I think the biggest thing is where defense attorneys and plaintiff attorneys connect is seeing is believing. If I was to say one thing and leave it one thing, I would say seeing is believing, because you could read interrogatories, which are just questions and answers. You can jump up and down and put whatever slide you want up on the board, but there's a lot to be said of hearing the sincerity of a voice, the way that people answers. Many times, if a person becomes combative, we just don't like that person. It could be my client, it could be your client. Whereas if a person comes in, and I had it was a sidewalk case, and you'll appreciate this one. Defense did a very good job. It was in Bucks County. It was a sidewalk that was 1.75 feet above ordinance or regulation. It was that much of a deviance. And that being said, the person that the defense brought in was the person that was the head of HOA. This guy was 85 years old, and obviously we're not suing him, we're suing the HOA, but this guy was 85 years old. He took the stand, he was the president, and by the end of his testimony, I wanted to hug the man. I wanted this guy to be my grandfather. I was like, this is awesome. Like, this is it. Thankfully, we got a fair verdict, but you would never anticipate that, or knowing that like during the deposition, if you were just reading a transcript, question, answer, question, answer. So the visual and the video and the pictures all become so much more impactful to driving a settlement. And one of the big things I always tell people is I'm not trying to settle a case. I'm trying to have the other side just see the light. Because if you walk into a mediation or you walk into a courtroom looking for a number, you're never going to hit that number unless you get a runaway jury, you get that trifecta that you just said, 10-year-old Philadelphia score, which you don't see many times often. You go in and you're just looking to learn and you're looking to help them see. There's so much more collaborative work that happens. And I think one of the biggest themes that we can talk about today, which might be a great endpoint too, is the collaborative work. As much as we are adversarial, as much as we want different goals, it's almost when one of us or both of us reach across the aisle and say, like, here's the middle point. Meet me here and we can get this done. How do you feel about that on your side? Is that something that you feel is definitely something that jumps in and is fair to say? Or do you sometimes think that you have to do the dance. The dance is what gets us here. But for the dance, there really isn't a collaborative effort.
So I think really early on, in most cases, you're going to do the dance just because we all have an obligation to our clients. We got to start somewhere. And most mediators, you know this, they want a demand and an offer exchange. And that's kind of, you've heard of, and the bracket, you know, your high, low, you know, the number is somewhere between this high and this low. And that's what we essentially lock ourselves into. Because if you come in and say, I want $500,000, and I say, I'll give you $100,000, you're not going to turn around and say, no, I want $700 tomorrow.
Sure.
Because I'm going to say, what do you want?
Yeah.
That's just not happening. And you know, even without thinking, we box each other in, or ourselves, really. But the other piece of that, too, is, again, depending on the exposure, if it's multiple $100,000, you're bringing your adjuster to that mediation. Again, that human connection. If you're in trial, someone from the insurer or the self-insured is coming to that trial. How many cases have you gotten an offer while the jury's out?
It's been countless. And it's just, again, from assessing that, being there in the know and putting a face to a name, or seeing juror four scratch their nose or look over at a certain way, and you try to get a tell on that. It's amazing how much gets done even when the jury is still deliberating. And that's one of the things, too. Like, even at trial, the people are going to show up from both sides. There's going to be support on both ends. It's just in court, and what I tell my clients all the time, and I'm sure you tell your insured, only thing I can promise you is I'm going to put the best case forward. I cannot promise you a number. Only thing that we can really put on the board is future care. We have wage loss, maybe. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the reality is that if you're a betting man and you don't like to go to the casino, trial's not for you. And I don't say that to sway you either way. I say that I have a duty to tell you that I can hit a home run grand slam day, and the jury could say, you know what, I didn't like Mr. DeBonis wearing that red tie every day. He looks with that watch on like he's making plenty of money, and they take it out on our client, or vice versa. They hear it from the defense side and they say, you know what, that guy really didn't look like he gave a hoot about anything. He stood there with his arms crossed. They didn't have any procedures in place. Let's send him to the moon. And that's where you see those runaway verdicts. So it's always interesting if you can avoid that flip of the coin, heads or tails, call it in the air, how many cases? And like I said, like I mentioned, I think under 1%, I think it's 3 to 5 in the percent range, actually go to trial. That's amazing.
I can give you a fantastic example. I'm out in Lebanon County. This is probably 2018, 2019. Pedestrian accident, pedestrian gets hit in the middle of the roadway. This little 88-year-old lady's driving the car and hits my client. It's dark out. It's like 6 o'clock in, you know, December, and she comes in. It's trials right after Easter. And the defendant is this little 88-year-old lady, sweetheart, and she's in all purple. And she takes the witness stand. The first thing the defense attorney says is, "What'd you do for Easter?" And I'm sitting there. That's got nothing to do with his case whatsoever. We all know that. But he's humanizing her to the jury. And the moment I object, which it would be sustained, which means my objection would be granted, but that hurts me 100 times more than it's ever going to help me. Because I've just made this little old lady look like I'm...
I idolized her just by that simple question. I think that's a great example.
So a defense attorney walks up to me while the jury's deliberating and says, "You out-niced me in this trial." He goes, "I'm concerned." And we're talking back and forth, and jury came back, and it ended up being a defense verdict.
Oh, wow.
So it was one of the younger judges who will talk to the jury after, and he comes up to us after, and the judge is telling us, you know, jury loved you. They loved your theory. They hated your client. And I'm just sitting there like, you can hit a home run, and the jury doesn't like how she, like, looked at the defense attorney. They thought she was making faces at the defense attorney during his argument, and they just felt that she wasn't a likable person.
And you have no control.
It's that simple.
You can coach into the blue and the moon, and that's the reality of it. That in conclusion, then, I think that's a great wrap-up point, because all we do to bring it to trial, and we try to work collaboratively together to avoid that pitfall or possibility of not having my client compensated. I mean, that's a good day for the defense side, but... In conclusion, I think if there's one thing that we learned today is we're more close in scope than we are. There might be a V across the aisle, but I think collaboratively talking this through, your day is very similar to mine. It just kind of takes on a different image, and there's different goals and objectives that are completed. But that being said, there's a lot to be learned when you work collaboratively together, and it's okay to agree to disagree when both of us just want the best for each other at the end of the day.
I agree. And my closing thought on that is your client sitting there, my client sitting there, we walk up to each other while the jury's out, you know, and we share a hug or, you know, shake hands, and, you know, we're asking about each other's kids, you know, just shooting the breeze while we're waiting. And they're looking at us like we're crazy. And, you know, I would tell my clients often, I'm friends.
Yeah. We're still humans at the end of the day.
We go out once a month, you know, we go out for dinner, you know, just because we're, like you just said, we're on different sides of the V, it doesn't mean it's not a collaborative effort. We have a job to do. That doesn't take away that we're human. You know, plaintiff attorneys aren't ambulance chasers, in fact. Defense attorneys aren't sharks and cheap, you know what, that's what it's kind of called. That's just not the reality. Insurance is a business. Every business wants to make money and spend as little as possible. Injured folks want to be compensated as much as possible because their lives have been substantially changed, oftentimes through no fault of their own. And that's just the system. And until someone has a better system, we're going to be having this conversation over and over.
And that's fine. Like we started off, I said, this is the kind of conversation that at the end of the day, we'd have a beer together. It's just the reality is that our life journey's taken us to different sides, but as much as they take us apart, they pull us back together. And guess what? Those roads are going to have to collide at some point, and why not make it a more graceful transition than anything else? So with that being said, I think we'll wrap this up on the injury pros, and I can't thank you enough for coming out and making yourself available to talk about all this. Wrapping up another episode, I believe this is episode 19, we're going to done this probably the art of injury litigation, seeing both sides. If you enjoyed what you heard today, listen, subscribe, check us out at theinjurypros.com or wherever you listen to your podcast. That may be YouTube, Spotify, and beyond. Everybody, stay well, stay safe, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks.